What a difference a day makes.
Statt am Flughafen zu warten, lege einen Zwischenstopp in Katar ein. Mit idyllischen Stränden und pulsierenden Souks. Schon ab 44 Euro pro Nacht kannst du Katar besuchen und ein 5-Sterne-Hotel genießen. Gehe auf visitqatar.com/stopover. Es gelten die allgemeinen Geschäftsbedingungen.
This is Cape Talk.
Good morning, Crystal Audison, standing in for Clarence Ford. Good morning, Chris, and how is England today?
Oh, it's cold, but gorgeous sunrises. The amazing thing about this time of year, Crystal, and it's lovely to see you, by the way, and I really can see you because there you are popping up on my computer monitor. You can't see me because I have no camera in here, so you just have this black screen. So you'll just have to imagine this Adonis-like visage staring from the screen at you. That won't be me. Perfect face for radio and all that. But no, it's really nice this time of year because we get the amazing sunrises that come up between some of the buildings where I live. And it's just absolutely gorgeous to get this, all the colours at the red end of the spectrum. Because obviously when you've got the sun very low on the horizon, it's coming through a long tract of atmosphere and you get clouds in that direction. And they scatter the light and you get this amazing effect. So I look forward to this time of year for that reason. But boy, is it cold otherwise. We're suddenly reverted to the seasonal norm.
I lived in Brighton, so I just remember the crisp blue sky, which, as you say, this time of year, one really appreciates it. But it's bitterly cold.
Yeah, and it's reverted to sort of seasonal norms because we've been somewhat shielded by having warm weather when we shouldn't have had unseasonably warm weather. And it was lurching from extremes. We had -3 a couple of days last week, and then suddenly it was 17 degrees over a weekend. I think we're getting back to sort of roughly where we should be for this time of year, but it's a bit of a shock, a bit of a wake-up call.
Yes, I can imagine. So, Chris, let's get straight into it. The lines have been inundated. I don't even know where to start.
All complaints about me, possibly.
No, we love you, Chris. We love you. But we'll start with Maggie. She says, what are the side effects of toothpaste that contain fluoride?
Ah, hello, Maggie. Well, the reason that fluoride is in there at all is because a number of decades ago, scientists, having unpicked the chemistry of teeth are made of a mineral called apatite. It's a mixture of calcium and phosphorus. And it's very tough. And that's why teeth, when you dig up people who've been buried many, many years, even thousands of years ago, you very often find bones, yes, but also teeth, because enamel is one of the hardest substances made in the animal kingdom. Scientists realise if you add a fluoride to the enamel, you get fluoroapatite, which is an even harder chemical. And as a result of that, we've been reinforcing the fluoride levels in water and toothpaste and other dental treatments for many, many years because it directly translates into a reduction in tooth decay and therefore gum disease. And believe it or not, gum disease is a really strong association with, or has a really strong association with, heart disease, high blood pressure and stroke. Because if you have inflammation in the gum line, it causes an increase in total body inflammation, which is a big risk factor for damaging your blood vessels. So actually, by putting fluoride in the water, one good side effect is not only do you save yourself on trips to the dentist and keep money in your wallet, not in the dentist's pocket, sorry dentists out there, but what you also do is cut down your risk of other systemic diseases like heart disease. Are there any negative effects? Well, the data are really very limited on this, and it makes for a good story. There's a lot of conspiracy theories and that kind of thing, but there's not good, strong, compelling evidence that we're doing harm, which majorly outweighs the benefits that we accrue from putting the fluoride there and saving people from trips to the dentist and therefore onward benefits to their health. So at the moment, the balance of opinion is that the evidence is in favour of putting fluoride reinforcement into drinking water, into toothpaste, and therefore helping people to cut down their dental carry rate.
Wow, thank you for that, Chris. A question from Luke. Luke is saying, how was physiotherapy discovered that if one does this types of exercises, they would accelerate healing of pain in joints and muscles and also a bit of inflammation?
Oh, hi, Luke. Well, if you think about it, We've actually evolved to move around. We have not evolved to be sedentary. And our body relies on us moving to keep the various humours in the body, blood, lymph and so on moving. Because although we have a heart to propel blood at high pressure down our arteries, which takes blood into tissues, getting blood back out of the tissues and back to the heart is more tricky because it's at low pressure. It's drained through all the tissues through very tiny blood vessels, lots of resistance to flow. Once it's in the tissues, much less resistance to much less pressure there. And so to get the tissue fluid, the lymph and the blood back to the heart, you need to give it a helping hand. And we have what's called a muscle pump. So when you go walking around, your muscles get shorter and fatter and take up more space, and they squeeze veins that run next to them. Because veins have valves in them, this puts the pressure up at the far end of the vein, makes it higher than at the heart end of the vein. So blood naturally flows back up following this vis at ergo, this muscle pump push in veins. So moving around is really, really critical for us. And part and parcel of physiotherapy is helping to reinforce that fluid movement out of tissues. Because if you remove blood from tissues, there's more space in the tissues for healthy oxygenated blood to come in. So it's good for blood flow, and that's good for tissue repair and healing anyway. But also, if you don't move joints, you don't move them through their full range, they can become stuck or they can become stiffened and have a reduced range of movement. And my wife fell over earlier in the year, tripped over a box I'd left on the floor. I was in big trouble for this, had to do the cooking for weeks. And she fell over a box I'd left there and broke her wrist. And they put you in a plaster cast and you're not moving the immobilized joints for 6-8 weeks. When that plaster cast comes off, you're very, very stiff. She still can't get the full range of movement in one direction in the wrist. But slowly extending and moving the joints back and forth, you do begin to recover that. So physiotherapy, absolutely critical. And when we have patients in hospital who, for instance, have a hip replacement, they're very surprised when the very next day after being operated on, they're up and about. And the physiotherapists are on the ward and they're saying, come on, up and about, we're going to go for a walk. And the patient's like, I've just had an operation. And you say, yes. And if you don't get up and about and walk, you never will. Because if we don't get people up and walking, they lose their muscle strength, they lose their muscle tone, and they lose their confidence. So it's one of the most important things we can actually do for people in healthcare.
Yes, good morning. I am in conversation with Dr. Chris Smith, our favourite naked scientist. From Keith, why is there a delay between live TV and radio?
Oh, hi, Keith. Almost certainly because of the processing. The amount of data being handled and transmitted and processed in live TV is considerable compared to just an audio track. So it can take longer for all that processing to happen with television. And therefore, there is a delay between when you make the programme and when the visuals appear. And in fact, broadcasters know this because if they're just transmitting audio, then they would have to sometimes resync the audio with the pictures to account for this. So they have ways of using computer software to delay the sound a bit so that it rematches with what the visuals are doing. The other thing to consider is the route that the television pictures have taken to get to you. Many of them come from satellites, and many satellites, including geostationary satellites, are used. These are satellites that occupy a certain orbit, about 36,000 kilometres up into space. And they sit there at the same position over the Earth's surface so that the Earth's surface can always see the satellite in that position and you can bounce important telecommunication signals off of it. So if you go out into the field and do a field report, for instance, you go to a disaster site or a particular area, and you send your television pictures back, they've taken a huge journey out into space and then back to the ground. This is why when you see the presenter in the studio say, and now over to our reporter who's out in the back of beyond, and there seems to be a massive delay after they say, what's going on there, John or Sue or something? And then they eventually say, oh yes, good afternoon, they start talking. This is because of that transmission delay, getting all the way up into space and back down to them, then them sending the signal back up into space and back down to you. Those signals have travelled a considerable distance compared to the very simple linear route that the output from the studio has taken to a transmitter close to you and then straight to your television system.
Thank you for that, Chris. From Mark Johnson, a follow-up regarding the fluoride question.
Just a follow-up question for the naked scientist about fluoride in toothpaste. So when it's in water, that fluoride is ingested and goes, you know, into your body by your digestive system. What I want to know is if it's in the toothpaste, that's just a short period of contact with that fluoride toothpaste. So it's a much shorter time. Do the teeth actually absorb the fluoride in that 1 or 2 minutes that you're brushing your teeth? Thanks a lot. It's Mark.
Hello, Mark. The answer is yes, absolutely. And the concentration of fluoride in a toothpaste is much, much higher than the concentration in drinking water. So you're taking a small amount in the drinking water in, and this is helping to make your bones strong, and it's helping to make your teeth strong from just contact with the teeth. But it's on a chronic basis, as in all day, every day, whereas in a toothpaste, where it's only incidental few times a day contact, you use a much higher concentration to achieve high mouth concentrations, and this gets into the teeth from the outside. So the water helps you form strong teeth, because as the teeth are growing in a youngster, then you're reinforcing their matrix and the enamel that way. So it's helping developing teeth. If you have it in toothpaste, you're helping to reinforce existing teeth, but you're using a high concentration to drive the fluoride onto the surface of the tooth, where it can make that crucial fluoroapatite, which is a very, very hard crystal, very resistant to breakdown. And dentists often say, when you brush your teeth, do not wash your mouth out after you've finished brushing your teeth. We all do it, don't we? We sort of get a load of water and swill it around our mouth and spit out the soapy bits down the sink. They're saying, don't do that, especially last thing at night. Go to bed and make sure you leave a little bit of that froth on your teeth, because the fluoride will carry on working when you're sleeping to reinforce your teeth that way.
Thank you for that, Chris. I will now remember that, because we all just do water. We've got another phone call. Good morning, Denise from Table View.
Good morning. I'd like to ask the doctor a question. Well, I actually read this. It says, according to a study, wind turbines measuring between 100 and 150 meters operating at night can pull down warmer air from as far as 1,640 feet in the air down to the surface, warming the surface of the earth, where it would impact on people, plants, and animals living near the turbines. So does this contribute to global warming?
Good morning. Well, the answer is that we're still studying how wind turbines will or won't affect the dynamics of the air around the areas where they are positioned. But the basic premise of a wind turbine is that they are extracting energy from the air in the form of kinetic energy, moving air, and this is being imparted to the blades of the turbine and then transferred to the alternator in the turbine to convert the kinetic energy in the air into electrical energy in a cable that we can use. Now, they're not making any energy, and they're not doing anything other than just moving energy and transforming energy from one form to another. They are contributing to the way that the air flows across the surface of the earth. That will make a difference, but there's no evidence that they're having any kind of appreciable warming effect or cooling effect downstream, as far as I know. I think there was a paper in the journal Joule a few years ago looking at this, and I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go and have a look for that reference, because I think they looked at this question. I don't think there's any evidence it makes an appreciable difference, but if there is any evidence that it does, I'll come back next week and I'll give you that extra information.
Thank you so much, Chris. I'm in conversation with our favourite naked scientist, Dr. Chris Smith. He's answering all our intriguing questions about science. So, Chris, a question from Tariq. He's saying, I would like to know, is the ISS going to be decommissioned in 2030? Can't they let it zoom off into infinity than to pay Elon Musk $800 million to let it crash into the ocean, never mind the environmental effect?
The answer is yes. Regrettably, the ISS is at end of life, and it is scheduled to be decommissioned in 2030. And it is falling apart. It's old now. It's an old lady. It's been up there for decades. And I think 24 years, I think now, it's been permanently staffed. I think that's the case. I think it's that long. But the point is, it's been there a very long time. It's leaking. There's one section, in fact, it's the Russian section, but we won't talk about that. But they've got a leak, and it's losing about a kilo or two of air every day from there. And they don't actually know where this leak is. They just know that there's a certain section that leaks, and they have to keep sealing it off. But of course, that's a big worry, because if a small leak's happening, it could turn into a big leak. And then you've got a problem with, well, what happens if it suddenly catastrophically depressurizes? Evacuation time. And the leak is affecting one region of the space station where one of the spacecraft that would be used to either resupply or evacuate the space station would dock. So that limits your possibilities as well. So the answer is yes, it is being decommissioned. Yes, 2030 is the time when that's scheduled to happen. It won't leave us with no space station in orbit, because there are other initiatives which are currently up there. The Chinese have a space station, for example. Also, there are a number of commercial ventures stepping in now to have commercial space stations that will perhaps operate as hotels and that kind of thing. Who knows? That sort of thing is genuinely coming. Why are they commissioning Elon Musk in order to help bring its life to an end? Well, the space station's not very high up in the atmosphere. It's only about 400 kilometres up. That's very low. It's so low, in fact, that it is actually travelling, doing its 1.5 hour orbits. That's how long it takes it to go all the way around the world and back. It's so low that it's brushing through tendrils of the Earth's atmosphere that extend out that far. And this means it's experiencing drag constantly, and that's slowing it down. So left to its own devices without a managed sort of end-of-life plan, it would just slowly decay on its orbit and then crash into the Earth somewhere. We have to periodically keep boosting it up to a higher orbit. And so part and parcel of a safety commission is to make sure it does that in a way which we can control, and we can predict where it's going to do that so it crashes harmlessly. It's not in an orbit where if we let it go, it would suddenly zoom off into space. That wouldn't happen. We'd have to give it enormous amounts of energy to push it up and up and up and then send it off somewhere. And why would we want to do that? There's a danger that we would crash it onto somewhere which is currently pristine and which it might contaminate. And we make enough of a mess of our own planet without making a mess of someone else's.
Thank you. There's a voice note.
Hey everybody, I just wondered if Dr. Chris can tell us whether you, if you're going on a space trip to complete the journey and come round in a great white circle, which will mean that you can only gain or lose 24 hours. You can't be like the twin paradox and come back and find your twin brother dead. Thanks very much. It's Stuart in Fishhook.
Hi, Stuart. I think what's being referred to here is the fact that as we travel, what he's saying by twin paradox is as we travel at higher and higher speeds, our perception of time doesn't change, but our measurement of time does. So in other words, if I synchronise, and this is the famous experiment, if I synchronise two extremely accurate and extremely precise clocks, and I send one of them into space at very high speed, and the other one I leave on the Earth, its twin, and I fly one of them around the world and bring them back together again, the one that's been travelling at very high speed has aged a bit less. It's counted less time than the one that was left on the ground. But the difference in timing is down at multiples of decimal points. It's literally billionths of seconds, I think, was the experiment that they found when they did this. So you're not going to be going anywhere soon in terms of flying around the world and doing this at a rate that would leave you alive and a twin who you left waiting for you dead. That isn't going to happen because the time difference at the speeds we were flying these things is so tiny.
Chris, a question from a listener. What causes genital warts? How does one get rid of them because there's no vaccine or treatment for them?
Well, it's not strictly true. There's no vaccine. There is. There's one of the most successful vaccines that I think has ever been made, now being routinely used to help with genital warts, which are caused by a virus. It's the human papillomavirus. This is a big family of viruses. There's about 50 or 60 different members of that family. And a few members of the family are strongly linked to genital warts. Other members of the family cause things like warts on the fingers and skin, foot verrucas and that kind of thing, but there is one particular pair of these viruses which are known to be strongly linked to causing genital warts. The other thing this virus does is cause cervical cancer, and the vaccines will protect people against having both cervical cancer and genital warts. So there is a vaccine. It can be prevented, but the vaccine is not helpful if you already have the problem, because the vaccine makes you make antibodies that stop you catching the virus and allowing it in to cause the problem in the first place. What do you do if you've already got it? Well, the answer is we can always do something. One, you need to make sure that you don't give it to anybody else. So while you have these lesions, they are releasing virus that can affect another person. So you absolutely have to make sure you practice safe sex or abstain while you've got these lesions. But that can be a problem because they can be there for a while, so it's important we manage people's expectations. They do take a while to go away. You should definitely go and get checked for other sexually transmitted infections, because if you've picked up one, birds of a feather flock together. Highly likely you might have run into other things that you don't realise might be there as well, and they can be treated at the same time before they become a problem. And we all know that there are a slew of those out there that we have to watch out for. So that's the other important piece of advice. And when you're getting checked out, they can then give careful advice on what treatments can be given for the warts that do exist – There are a range of different interventions that can be used, but if you don't have any interventions, they will eventually go away, but it can take a while, but there are ways to deal with them. If you haven't got any warts yet and you haven't had the cervical cancer and genital warts vaccine, this is a really good opportunity to do it. Studies done in the UK, I met a friend of mine, is Margaret Stanley, who used to work at the University of Cambridge. She's retired now, but she helped to develop that vaccine, and she showed me the data the other day, and this has brought cervical cancer cases in Scotland, where they looked at the data most recently, to almost zero. Absolutely wow. Amazing achievement. And it's happening all over the world now. So definitely ask about getting that vaccine if you haven't already. But you have to have it, critically, you have to have it before you start having any kind of sexual contact, because it only works to stop the virus getting into the tissue in the first place. Once it's in, it's a bit too late.
And is there a cutoff date, Chris, for having the HPV vaccine?
No, we try to help people when they're very, very young, because as Margaret puts it, it's before a person's sexual debut, before they get sexually active, because then you've made the immune protection. So if you do run into the infection, you are protected. It doesn't mean it doesn't work in older people, but you're more likely to have run into the viruses when you're older and you're already sexually active. And for that reason, you're slamming the door after the horse has bolted. And it's not everyone who has a problem with these viruses. Most of the population without these vaccines would become infected. Only a small minority would end up with problems because of them. But obviously for them, it's a big problem.
Thank you so much, Chris. Always a pleasure to hear your expansive knowledge. I always find it so interesting. And of course, I take notes because it's things that I wasn't aware of. So thank you so much, Chris.
You're very welcome.
Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Crystal. Bye, everyone. See you next time.
This is Cape Talk. Cape Talk.
What a difference a day makes.
Bei einem Zwischenstopp in Katar erlebst du idyllische Strände und pulsierende Souks. Und schon ab 44 Euro pro Nacht kannst du es dir in einem 5-Sterne-Hotel gut gehen lassen. Gehe auf visitqatar.com/stopover. Es gelten die allgemeinen Geschäftsbedingungen.